For the first time ever in LA, the icons of FC Barcelona and Real Madrid take the pitch at BMO Stadium.
Ronaldinho, la pura magia!
Witness Ronaldinho and the FC Barcelona legends live in Los Angeles. Watch the Legend Series, FC Barcelona versus Real Madrid, live in LA on February 22nd at BMO Stadium. For tickets and exclusives, go to wearehouseofheroes.com.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Chapter 10 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording's in the public domain. Chapter 10. Dane turned onto the Maubeuge Road and brought the MG to an even 40 miles an hour. Susan Bellows leaned back in the seat, her eyes half-closed, body relaxed. Warmth poured down on her upturned face, and the sun gleamed red against her eyelids. A long line of plane trees cast their shadows one by one against her, an endless succession of shadows passing like birds in flight. Warmth, sun, and shadow produced an almost hypnotic state, enforced by the even droning of the engine, by the faint vibration of the seat. She felt childishly happy, defenseless, gratefully released from her cocoon of anxiety. Through half-closed eyes, she looked at Dane and saw him imprisoned in silky strands of her hair, upright behind the steering wheel, unaware that he was trapped in the net of her hair. Still playing his game of spies and G-men, although it was well past supper time. She looked at him fondly, but already there was a stirring of resentment behind her look, for she sensed her urge to control behind the grotesque matronly smile. She believed, with astonishment as always, that they would go to bed together. The astonishing sexuality of a car in motion had set it off. Motion, vibration, the even succession of light and dark, these things had seduced her before a word could be spoken or a hand outstretched. She had seduced herself, that was inevitably her weakness, all women's. And Dane, silent behind the wheel of the rushing car, played only the part of a stranger come to participate in prearranged temple rites. He was needed, but he had to bear the resentment strangers met everywhere. At this moment she loved Dane as truly as she could, without stability, without hope. She was deadened to commonplace stimulation. She suspected that most women were, and she responded only to this distant, subtle, cold touch across her deadened nerve ends. She responded suspiciously, but with gratitude, blessing indirection in a world of direct shock, grateful for the presence of a stranger amongst the regiments of familiar faces. It would be terrible to know him now, hideous to understand him. Understanding gave the Judas kiss to pleasure, and changed the miraculous moment into a polite affair of coiled bodies and cold morning coffee. For her, to know all was to despise all. She didn't want to love a man. It was better to love a pair of tanned hands on a white plastic steering wheel. The car slowed, and the even succession of light and dark gave way to an even grayness, faintly cold to her face. Annoyed, she opened her eyes fully. They were coming into a town. She sat upright and looked around.
Where are we?
Approaching Maubeuge. We should find out something here about the thief.
To hell with the thief.
What's the matter with you? She looked at him with the special intense loathing reserved for disappointing lovers.
I have a slight headache. Would you mind giving me a cigarette?
Upright and silent, they drove to the border station. They found that the police had stopped the wrong man. No further word had come from Amsterdam. In 15 minutes they were on the road to Paris.
But why did you give a correct identification of him to the police? Zetner asked.
I had no choice, Van Joost told him. You must remember the old woman and two policemen had also seen him. At least they had caught a glimpse of him.
Zetner seemed to be considering this.
I contacted the organization as soon as possible, Van Joost said. And I warned you about Mr. Adelgate. Have you done anything about Mr. Adelgate?
Zetner didn't answer. He stood silently in Van Joost's store, the gloved fingers of his left hand tapping lightly on the counter, his raincoat buttoned to the throat. Van Joost had undergone that day 3 separate interrogations, from the police, from Dutch security, and from the American. This talk now with the man from his own organization was by far the worst. The others could be lied to, cajoled, and treated. But this man, who Joost himself summoned, stood silent and contemplative in front of him, unmoved by truth or lies, pursuing some unknowable train of thought of his own. This man represented power. A word from him could cut off party funds, and then the store would fail, as it should have failed 15 years ago.
"You should not have given them a correct identification," Zettner said at last.
"I did not think fast enough," Joost said. "I was without instructions. I became confused, but I contacted the organization just as soon."
"The organization can't think out everything for you. We can't arrange your shelves and speak to your customers."
Joost nodded dumbly. It seemed almost certain now that his party funds would be reduced, perhaps stopped altogether.
"What will you do if the police catch this man and ask you to identify him?"
"I will not identify him," Joost said.
Triumphantly, he added,
"I will lie."
"Clumsily?"
"Not at all. They will learn nothing from me."
"What about the American? Suppose he questions you?"
"Mr. Dane, he is the easiest one of all. A child could lie to him."
"That is your considered opinion."
Sarcasm was lost on Van Joost. He said eagerly,
"I'm certain of it. He didn't look very bright, and he hardly paid attention when he questioned me. Even the girl, the other witness, acted brighter, but Mr. Dane hardly seemed to hear me."
"So, of course, you talked a little faster to make sure he heard you."
"I didn't," Joost said. He added reproachfully, "You must give me credit for some intelligence."
Zettner seemed lost in a dream. His handsome face had the look of a boy engaged in a deadly serious game of hide-and-seek. Watching him, Joost was filled with admiration. In spite of 15 years in the service of militant materialism, he was superstitious, a believer in signs and portents, childishly proud as the Eastern world assimilated the manners of the bourgeois world he was a part of, and which he was dedicated to destroy. This man, Joost thought, was an accomplishment as great as a hydroelectric dam, and far more meaningful. With the coming of strong, subtle young men like Zettner, the battle was joined on still other fronts. Joost's admiration was so intense that he barely noticed the movement of Zettner's right hand into the deep pocket of his raincoat. The hand slid out again, and in it was a small-caliber automatic.
"Just one moment," Joost said. "Perhaps I haven't explained myself thoroughly enough."
His words were lost in Zettner's vast indifference. Zettner had found the action appropriate to the moment. Without haste, he reached into the pocket again, took out a silencer, and fitted it to the barrel. Joost watched, panic showing only in an uncontrollable pulse in his throat.
"The truth of the matter is," Joost said, I see where my actions were wrong. I will correct them. Listen to me for a moment. I have been too far removed from the movements of the party, but on orders from the party. I have been left without guidance. I cannot be blamed for a lapse. I cannot..."
"No one is blaming you," Zettner said.
He cocked the automatic and raised it to the level of his chest. Van Joost's lips moved soundlessly, spraying the counter with a fine spittle. Zettner fired, placing the bullet neatly between Joost's rapidly blinking eyes, just above the bridge of the nose. Joost stared at him, caught in mid-blink. Then he backed a step and fell with a small sound for so large a man. Zettner put the automatic away, stepped behind the counter, and scooped a handful of watches into his pocket. Then he left. On the way back, he stopped at a little bridge over the Vurbygwal Canal. It was dark and deserted. Zettner leaned against the parapet, and one by one he dropped the watches into the water. Then he took off his gloves and returned to the hotel.
"Was it really necessary?"
Bardief asked him.
"Of course," Zettner said. "Van Joost was too weak to have faced any police pressure. We couldn't afford to have him identify the thief."
Zettner lay slumped in a chair in the suite he shared with Bardief. He was smoking a cigarette, quite a rare thing for him, but not at all indicative of tension. He knew that smoking was one of those activities labeled pleasures. Zettner experimented with pleasures from time to time, to further his insight into human beings. He knew it was very important to understand how people reacted, and what they reacted to. He was a diligent student of human nature. "It will look like a robbery," he told Bardif. "It will be just one more of the thousands of crimes committed every year in the West. One day in the newspapers, a week of investigation, and then nothing."
"First Adelgate, and now Joost," Bardif said.
Zetner sat upright. "Does it really disturb you? I thought army men understood expediency." Bardif shrugged off the question. He had been in the army for 12 years, 8 of them commanding troops, 4 in a political capacity. The party had seen his value and reliability and had judged him more valuable for external affairs. He had been transferred to Canton, then Bucharest, and at last to London. Except for occasional holidays, he had not lived in Russia for nearly 10 years. Perhaps he had been too long away from home. It struck him that Zetner, nominally his subordinate, might have been sent to test the depth and extent of his reliability, might even have been sent to confirm a decision already made concerning him. Bardif said,
"The disposal of Van Joost and Adelgate solves very little. The American woman, Miss Bellows, is still accompanying Dane. She can identify the thief."
Zetner gave a slight, impatient shrug. "Obviously, so she must be killed." He used the word with a faint expression of pride. No euphemisms were possible for a realist.
"And Dane?"
"He also should be killed."
"And then will you kill the next CIA man assigned to the case, and the one after that?"
"You should not be willfully obtuse," Zetner said. "Not even as a joke. Or were you joking?" Bardif refused to be baited. Good humor had kept him alive too long for him to respond now to a creature like Zetner. He said,
"You young men can be curiously old-fashioned. Next you'll want to put a bomb in the Louvre."
"Terror has its uses."
"Of course. Why not blow up Versailles? Perhaps someone will erect a factory on its site."
Zetner smiled. He understood humor, though he found its practical application difficult. "Terror is not as old-fashioned as you think. Any means are permissible when they bring the desired end. To categorize a thing as old-fashioned is to be guilty of sentimental thinking." He finished his cigarette and put it out carefully in an ashtray. "You're out of touch, Bardif. Terror is returning."
"Is that your latest instruction?"
"It is self-evident. Or do you prefer other means?" Bardif smiled and shrugged. "I think you have grown too fond of meaningless subtlety," Zetner said. "You should be careful of it."
"This is a discussion for children," Bardif said, getting to his feet. "Kindly spare me your textbook quotations. This operation is your responsibility. When do you wish to remove Dane and the girl?"
"Very soon," Zetner said. "First, I must make a plan."
"I'm going to sleep," Bardif said.
He went into his bedroom. Alone in the darkness, Bardif lay fully clothed on the bed, his hands clasped behind his muscular neck, a cigarette smoldering in the ashtray beside him. His delicately attuned instinct for survival had been aroused by Zetner's clumsy attempt to bait him. He felt no anger toward the man. The Zetners were historically inevitable, but he felt necessarily protective toward him. There was no open battle between them yet. Perhaps there never would be one. Zetner was not a slavish fool with a notebook, a simple extension of some faction's ear to Moscow with a condemnation already in his pocket, searching only for documentation of a predetermined fact. It was a pity he wasn't. That sort of thing could be handled. Zetner was nothing like that. He was, instead, a new product of the conditioning process, a child of the stable state, rather than of the revolution. And, Bardif suspected, his thinking might be polarized toward Peking rather than Moscow. He grinned, took a final drag, and put out the cigarette. In that thought might lie the salvation if the situation ever became serious. But in the meantime there was the thief to catch, and Dane and the girl to be disposed of. Bardif undressed and got into bed. He felt an almost affectionate pity for Zetner. Young, dedicated, humorless, untraveled, and therefore tending to oversimplify the problems of an ancient and unruly world. Just before going to sleep, Bardif wondered what Zetner would be like drunk. It would be interesting to see. The young man needed to learn. in a hurry, that no human is perfect, no matter how hard he tries. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 11. At CIA's European headquarters in Paris, Dane learned nothing new about the movements of the thief. Since the man hadn't been seen again in Amsterdam, it had to be tentatively assumed that he had left the city, and probably the country, for an unknown destination. The border alerts had so far proven ineffective. Just how the man had done it, escaped a police trap and eluded or outrun the guards at all border checkpoints, was still a matter for conjecture. Some, including Dane, thought it was beginner's luck. Others felt that the man's success argued some sort of organized help. The extent of this conjectured help was completely unknown, but according to a persistent rumor, the thief was being aided by a prominent neutralist Asian power. This in turn gave rise to the theory that the man was really not a sailor, and therefore was not as naive as his movements would seem to indicate. He was instead a spy and agent provocateur, representing a third power, and trying to stir up as much trouble as possible among the NATO nations on the one hand, between NATO and the Soviet Union on the other hand, and possibly even between the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact countries on the third hand. This theory, although it stirred some interest in Washington, was not favored in Paris. Until new information was received, the simplest working hypothesis was to take the facts at their face value. Dane learned that John Adelgate had been found in his London store hanging from a noose, an apparent suicide. But the police surgeon believed that his neck had been broken before he was hung. In Amsterdam, Van Joost had been murdered, apparently by a thief, more likely by members of the same group who had killed Adelgate. The briefcase from which the papers had been taken was in the hands of the London police. A maid in a sailor's boarding house had found it under a mattress and had almost thrown it out, but had decided to tell the constable at the corner first. There were clear fingerprints on the metal, but they couldn't be matched with any in the files. No one in the boarding house could be sure of the appearance of the man who had occupied the room in which the briefcase had been discovered. Turnover had been heavy that week. Inquiries had been made at all the major shipping lines in London. No crewman was missing, but nearly 400 sailors of Latin birth or probable appearance were on leave or signed off at the moment. Sailors from Italy, Corsica, Spain, and the Central and South American countries. This list didn't include the dozens of small 2- and 3-ship companies or the tramp steamers. Investigations were going on. They might take months. All in all, Dane decided it was a mess. There was no way of predicting where the thief would turn up, what he would do, or who he would try to contact. Dane could only wait, keep a constant watch on reports, and stay close to Susan Bellows. She was the only witness he had at present. Although she had been kept out of the news, her life had to be considered in danger. The big question was, who would the thief approach next? End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 12. Julian Scarborough was a young man of precise habits and modest ambitions. Early upon his appointment to the State Department through the good offices of Senator Howell Wallens, Scarborough had patterned himself upon the best models available for a young diplomat, and had molded himself to them to the extent allowed by good taste, self-esteem, and a knowledge of station. Scarborough was eclectic. His speech, originally flavored somewhere west of Boston, had softened and lengthened, and now you might think he was an Englishman trying valiantly to overcome standard English. In dress, Scarborough was correct but not presumptuous. His suits were modestly and unaggressively British, his hats and ties tended toward the quieter Italian models, and in deference to his post in Paris, his sports clothing was purchased in the better French shops. Julian Scarborough was a model of assimilation, having altered himself in little more than a year from a tentative and self-effacing upperclassman on the campus of a huge Midwestern university to a quiet, self-assured, decisive junior diplomat. Even his sponsor, Senator Hal Wallens, who had done no more than perform a routine favor for the son of an influential constituent, was pleasantly surprised. He had been heard to say,
I'll be damned if I don't think that boy is going somewhere after all.
Hal's faint note of surprise can be attributed more to his general feeling that the young were going to hell in a basket than to anything specific he saw in Julian. For his part, Julian worked well and hard in his job as a junior assistant attaché in the American Embassy in Paris. His future seemed assured, a modest gentleman's rise up an almost imperceptible slope of success. Only luck, which has been known to lurk even in the corridors of embassies, could accelerate his progress, or conversely, retarded utterly. Luck, in its usual beggarly disguise, was given its chance. Every day, rain or shine, Julian left the embassy at noon, sometimes with friends, more often alone, and lunched at the Café Margot, a modest establishment which Michelin had overlooked. Here Julian fought to reconcile the contradictions between his American palate and the world-famous French cuisine. In the evening, sometimes with friends, more often alone, he left the embassy and went straight to the Spagna, another excellent place where the food was diced and sauced, herbed and spiced, and its native taste concealed utterly in a triumph of French artistry. After nibbling there, Julian walked 10 blocks to Annay's, a left-bank place which had found itself on the right bank, and whose clientele was mostly young diplomats who enjoyed watching bearded and irreverent bohemians drinking coffee. A pleasant hour could be spent there reading a bound copy of Figaro or Temps for the improvement of his already very acceptable French, and then home to bed. On the night when double-faced luck was given its chance, Julian had reached the Annay at 10 o'clock in the evening, had ordered his coffee, and was already absorbed in an article on Javanese influence in West Africa. Julian did not think of this sort of reading as work. It was no more than his duty to keep up to date on political situations anywhere in the world. He became aware that a man, sitting at a table nearby, was staring directly and rudely at him. Julian was not discomfited. Diplomats of any rank must learn to live in the often unwelcome spotlight focused by those whose destinies they determine. Julian glanced at the fellow once, coolly, and returned to his paper. But, absurdly enough, he was unable to concentrate. The article on Javanese influence in West Africa, although written with that French lucidity and clarity which is the envy of the world, failed to hold him in its spidery grasp. He had seen that staring fellow before. Julian prided himself upon his ability to recall names and faces. Now he flipped quickly through the file cards of his memory, trying to place that shock of black hair, those small, deep-set black eyes, that olive skin, and short, muscular body. Cards for 2 Latin American anarchists, a former Italian prime minister, and a Finnish press correspondent popped into view and were rejected. But now that he thought of it, this fellow had been skulking around the embassy grounds for the past few days, had almost certainly followed him to the Café Margot one afternoon, and here to the Annay perhaps more than once.
"You from the American embassy?"
the man asked, in barbarously accented English. Julian's one swift glance had been enough to precipitate a conversation. Julian nodded. Nothing more seemed required. As graciously as he could, he turned back to his newspaper. But the man, in the unfailing fashion of boors anywhere in the world, refused to let the embryonic conversation die so easily. He came over and sat down at Julian's table.
"You a diplomat in the Secret Service, maybe?"
Julian turned once again to the unkempt stranger. He did not believe in insulating himself completely from all contact with the non-diplomatic world. That meant being out of touch. And lack of contact with the hordes they served had been one of the most signal failures of the older diplomacy. On the other hand, it was difficult to see what could be gained from this particular contact.
"I am in the American embassy,"
Julian said. It seemed a perfectly safe answer.
"But not Secret Service?"
"I prefer not to discuss specific assignments."
Sure. You're a diplomat,"
the man said, showing a keenness of perception, surprising in an obviously unlettered man. He frowned.
"You're sort of young to be a diplomat."
"That is as it may be,"
Julian replied quickly and crushingly. The man nodded, his shock of coarse black hair bobbing ludicrously. Despite Julian's very apparent reserve, the man was determined to be friendly.
"I bet you work on all kinds of important stuff, yeah?"
Julian smiled faintly.
"That's good,"
the man said. He looked swiftly around him in a ludicrous conspirator's glance. Then he turned again to Julian.
"You ever by any secrets, huh?
The questions they asked. Julian smiled and turned back to his coffee.
On account of I've got a pal who's got a secret to sell for only $5,000 cash.
There was no adequate retort. Julian simply raised his eyebrows.
This pal of mine,
the man continued,
he stole this top American secret. I think maybe he didn't really steal it, but anyhow he got it. He thought about selling it to the Russians, but I told him he shouldn't do that. It isn't right. Besides, the Russians can't always be trusted. I told my friend, look, if you're going to do this thing, why not sell the American secret back to the Americans? No, the Americans got more money than the Russians, and it is better to deal with the Americans. That is what I told my friend. He said to me, Juanito, I do not care who I sell secrets to as long as I get my money, but I do not know any Americans who buy secrets. So I told him I would see what I could do.
The olive-skinned little man looked at Julian hopefully. Julian looked back with a total lack of expression.
So, anyhow, my friend said, Juanito, you see about it if you want to. Me, I don't trust the Americans or the Russians. I'm going to stay out of sight, and if you want to see me, you speak to this friend of mine, who knows another friend of mine. He's clever, this man, and no one could find him if he didn't want to be found. But I think he will sell his secrets if you and the other Americans want to buy them. He only wants $5,000, because he says it is a small sum for a government, and it is all he needs.
Is that all?
Julian asked icily.
Isn't that enough?
Julian put his fingertips together and stared at them judiciously, in a manner similar to that employed by the senior assistant attaché in the embassy. He looked up and said quietly,
My friend, what kind of a fool do you take me for?
Huh?
Have you any conception of the number of people who come to the American Embassy or approach its personnel with an offer to sell secrets?
It is a big market.
No, you don't seem to understand. I'm trying to tell you that every confidence man in Europe seems obsessed with the idea that Americans are big, happy, dull-witted people who cheerfully put up money for anything labeled secret. The number of fraudulent secrets we are offered even in a single month is almost unbelievable.
But, sir,
secrets, Julian said, warming to his subject. There are more secrets for sale in Europe than fake Persian rugs in the Near East. Urchins on street corners try to sell us secrets. People even give us secrets, gratis. It calls for the work of an entire department just to check and discard the secrets that we get in the course of a normal working day. And I'm told the Russians experience the same difficulties.
Although he had followed Julian with difficulty, the little man apparently understood most of what he heard. He said,
I didn't know it was like that.
Take my word, it is. Tell your friend to try it on the Russians. We Americans aren't handing out any free money this year.
Although obviously discouraged, the little man was not yet defeated. He said,
Perhaps other people in your embassy.
They'll all give you the same answer. Julian replied, We simply do not buy unsolicited secrets.
I can understand now your fear of being cheated,
said the little man.
I had not thought of it before, but in this case the secret is a real secret, a true and valuable secret. Listen, in London, not more than a week ago, an American was robbed of his secret by four ambulance men. Perhaps you have heard of this affair.
Go on.
Julian said.
The ambulance men were in turn robbed by my friend who saw his opportunity and seized it. This is true. This can be verified. Then a day later in Amsterdam, when my friend tried to sell his secret to a Soviet agent, he was very nearly captured by the police. The papers were that important, and American secret servicemen had worked that fast. But there is even more. After that, when my friend had come to Paris, a friend of his read to him aloud from a Dutch newspaper. He wanted to see if the newspapers in Amsterdam said anything about him. And there, in the newspaper, it said that this man, to whom he had tried to sell the secrets, do you follow me, sir? That this Dutchman, who was a Soviet agent, had been killed in what the newspapers said was a robbery. Have you heard about this?
I have not, Julian said.
But surely you have heard of the first... The stealing of the secrets in London.
We have not heard of it, Julian said, and I can assure you that had it happened, we would have heard of it. News like that is relayed instantly to the more important embassies. I'm afraid that your friend's story is nothing more than a tissue of lies from beginning to end.
The little man wanted to argue, but Julian cut short any further discussion. He paid his bill and left, once again advising the man to try his story on the Russians. At the embassy next day, Julian and several of his friends had a good laugh over the story. Obviously, the friend had been the man himself, and obviously the story had been the product of a vivid but undisciplined imagination. It was too good a story to keep in Juliet's immediate circle, his superior was told and chuckled appreciatively. He had encountered similar things himself. He told his superior, who also found it amusing. Then the story began to fade and might have been forgotten if an American security agent had not made his obligatory visit to the embassy soon after his arrival in Paris. The agent, a CIA alarmist, saw nothing funny about the story. Astoundingly enough, he took it seriously. And even more astounding, he had documentary evidence of the truth of the little man's assertions. Julian spent the next week in a frantic, unrewarding search through the most unsavory parts of Paris. The little man seemed to have vanished from sight. This was unfortunate for Julian Scarborough's career. Detection of the spy whom luck had thrown across his path would almost certainly have meant promotion. As it was, Julian came very close to dismissal. He was saved only by the fact that his superior and his superior's superior had laughed with him at the story and had told him that he had handled the whole thing very well indeed. End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 13. Bardief knocked on Zettner's door and went in. Zettner was sitting in an armchair reading a book on the industrial uses of atomic energy.
"No word?" he asked.
"Nothing," Bardief told him. "The man has dropped completely out of sight."
"He'll appear again. The plans are useless to him. He must find a buyer, and we represent the logical buyer."
"The thief may not be a logical man."
"It's just a question of waiting," Zettner said.
But he did not seem to enjoy the waiting. His fingers tapped an insistent tattoo against the side of the armchair. As soon as he became aware of it, Zettner stopped.
"I'm going out for dinner," Bardief said. "Would you care to join me?"
"I don't think so," Zettner said. "I plan to have dinner sent up. There are several reports I must write."
"I don't believe you've eaten in any of the good restaurants here."
"I haven't, as a matter of fact."
"Zettner, a plate of French food will not corrupt you. I think you owe it to yourself to try it. Western man must sometimes be understood through his appetites. A direct knowledge of those appetites would serve your education very well."
"I understand the people in France very well," Zettner said, a little angrily. "Perhaps I understand them better than you."
"Perhaps," Bardief said. "What's the matter with you tonight? Are you trying to pick a fight with me?"
Zettner turned away, his face sullen. After a moment, he raised his head.
"I received a letter from home today." Bardief knew that. He nodded politely. "My wife is leaving me," Zettner said. He added quickly, "It is not a matter of any concern. We were never in love, never the slightest hint of it. We did find ourselves attracted to each other, but there was no talk of love."
Bardief nodded and sat down on the edge of Zettner's bed.
"We both had our work to do," Zettner said. "We agreed beforehand not to impose any artificial limits on each other. We recognized at the start that the arrangement might not be permanent. It would have been ridiculous to think otherwise. Naturally, we agreed to grant each other immediate freedom at any time with no sentimental nonsense about it."
"How long had you been married?"
Bardief asked. "It would have been 2 years next month."
"That is a fairly long time," said Bardief, who had been married for close to 20 years.
"I thought the relationship was stable," Zettner said. "Still, it makes no difference. It isn't as though either of us had been in love." He hesitated, then added, "But I wasn't prepared for it. I will admit that I find its effect depressing. I would rather have been told to my face."
Bardief nodded. The two men sat in silence for a few seconds, and then Zettner's forefinger began to tap against the side of the chair. Bardief stood up abruptly.
"I am going to dinner. Will you join me, Zettner?"
This time, Zettner didn't hesitate. "Yes, I'll be pleased to join you. What should I wear? I have a dark blue suit.
That will be perfectly acceptable, Bardeev said.
An hour later, at a restaurant near the opera, Zetner was picking his way through a bouillabaisse and declaring it was tasty but effete, and not really comparable to plain fish soup. He protested when Bardeev ordered wine. It was ridiculously expensive, and besides, he had drunk French wines at home. Bardeev insisted that the product should be tried in its native environment. Zetner sipped judiciously and agreed that it was superior to the wines that could be obtained at home. He drank a second glass and called the waiter over.
"What exactly is the alcoholic content?" Zetner asked.
The waiter didn't know. Bardeev said that the content by volume was much less than in vodka, perhaps two-thirds less. Zetner said that was obvious. He himself preferred vodka. French wine, he said, bore a spiritual resemblance to American Coca-Cola. It could not be considered a manly drink. It was palatable, however. He and Bardeev finished the bottle, and over Zetner's protests, Bardeev ordered a second.
"Do you know," Zetner said later, "I'm glad I came out to dinner with you. My sense of depression seems to have vanished."
"Have another drink," Bardeev advised.
Zetner refused at first. Alcohol in quantity was a drug no less potent than heroin or cocaine. A realist did not have to have his mind clouded by drugs. Nevertheless, as the evening progressed, Zetner absent-mindedly drank several more glasses from a third bottle which Bardeev had ordered. When they left the restaurant, Zetner was in remarkably good spirits. It was his suggestion that they take a stroll through Montmartre. In a dim little café, Bardeev asked if Zetner had ever drunk scotch. He had, but he had not as yet sampled rye or bourbon. In spite of the prices, Bardeev felt that these typically American drinks should be tried, too. Zetner allowed himself to be persuaded. He found that he did not like the taste of rye or bourbon, and by mutual consent they switched to vodka. By 2 in the morning there was a flush on Zetner's cheeks, a faint thickness to his speech, but no sign of unsteadiness in his walk. Bardeev, who had been taking one drink to Zetner's 2, was amazed at his colleague's capacity. Now he was frankly curious. He decided to push the experiment a step further. Zetner came awake with a start. He found he was sitting in an overstuffed chair, and his left foot had gone to sleep. In his nostrils was a smell of soiled linen and florid perfume. He shook his left foot, and an acrid taste of nausea rose in his throat. He gulped down hard and looked around. He was in a small, cheerless parlor, flanked on their side by floor lamps that rose above him like disapproving sentinels. Across the room sat a middle-aged woman dressed entirely in black, knitting something black. She lifted her head and looked at him, continuing to knit with what struck Zetner as a maniacal speed and intensity.
"Where is my friend?" he croaked in miserable French.
"He left 2 hours ago. He said he would see you at the hotel."
"He left me here? Asleep?"
"You were not asleep then, monsieur. You were extremely lively."
"Was I?" Zetner asked.
The woman nodded grimly. Zetner turned slightly away. The sight of those flashing needles was beginning to make him dizzy.
"Extremely lively," she said. "You insisted upon ordering 4 bottles of champagne."
"Did I drink them?"
"A portion of them. The rest you gave to the girls."
Zetner racked his memory, but he couldn't remember any girls. He couldn't even remember how he had come to this place. His head was pounding now. He had never felt so sick in his life.
"So there were girls here," Zetner muttered, determined to outline the main points of the evening.
"Certainly,"
the woman said.
"What else would there be here?"
Zetner shuddered. He pulled himself to his feet and turned to find the door. The woman said,
"There is the matter of payment."
"Didn't my friend—"
"Of course, but there is also the time you spent here after your friend left."
Zetner extracted a wad of francs from his wallet, crossed the room, and held them out. The woman put down her knitting long enough to take most of them. Zetner hurried to the door.
"Au revoir, monsieur,"
she called after him. It was well past dawn when he returned to the suite he shared with Bardeev. The chilly morning air had cleared his head and quieted his stomach. He found Bardeev in the living room, wrapped in a bathrobe, reading a book.
"My dear Zetner, I was just going out to see how you were."
"Why did you take me to that place?" Zetner asked in a voice of iron.
"Take you?
Zetner, you took me. You insisted.
That is impossible. I don't know the location of any places like that.
Bardief explained patiently how Zetner, made somewhat carefree by a mixture of alcoholic beverages, had wanted to proposition the first woman who passed by. When restrained from this, he had asked, demanded, in fact, that they find a suitable place. No visit to Paris, he had declared, was complete without an inspection of its most notorious commodity. Zetner listened with a mixture of horror and fascination to the actions of a stranger who, it seemed, was himself.
What happened then?
We found the sort of place you wanted, actually. You found it. You positively seem to have an instinct.
Bardief, this can't be true.
It is, I assure you.
Why did you leave me in that place?
I stayed with you for over an hour, Bardief said reproachfully. I tried to bring you home, but you opposed the idea quite vehemently. I left finally so that we would have at least one person here to answer the telephone.
You say I was vehement?
To put it mildly.
Did I talk much?
You hadn't come there to talk.
My behavior must have been disgraceful, Zetner said tentatively.
Not at all, Bardief said. Quite the contrary, your behavior was amazingly forceful. It reminded me of the old days when we first entered Berlin. You should have gone into the army, Zetner. Perhaps some day you will.
It was completely atypical of me. I'm afraid it might be misunderstood.
There's no reason why anyone should know about our little evening, Bardief said. No reason at all.
Zetner stood perfectly still. He focused with difficulty on Bardief, noticing the small smile, the quietly folded hands.
Bardief, you are a bastard. I'll repay you for this. I swear I will.
He might have said more, but suddenly he was forced to turn and run into the bathroom. Bardief watched him go, then lighted a cigarette. It was really a pity about poor Zetner, he thought. A brilliant young man, but just the slightest bit unstable. It would be Bardief's duty to put some indication of this on Zetner's monthly fitness report. End of chapter 13.
Chapter 14 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 14. Over the next days, nothing new was heard about the thief. Agents and informants of East and West could find no trace of him. Word of their failure drifted back to Moscow and Washington. Questions were asked of embarrassed intelligence officials, and appropriate reinforcements were sent to Paris. For Bardief, the reinforcements were an unpleasant surprise, since they were put under Zetner's command instead of his. At the same time, he received word that General Prokof, the head of Security West, had been transferred from his Moscow command to the 15th Army stationed near the Afghanistan border. Prokof was Bardief's sponsor, a tough old soldier of sound political views, characterized like Bardief by his ability to favor no faction openly, to show no unseemly desire for power, to do his job and ignore the inner struggles of the regime he served. Bardief spent several hours considering the implications of the general's transfer. Had the old man become too outspoken, or too reticent? Or had this move been made simply to put a new man into Security West, a man who would commit himself more fully to current faction politics? No matter what the reason, Bardief knew that his own position had been rendered insecure. He was caught, whether he willed it or not, in the Byzantine politics, the torturous intrigues of the Moscow High Command. Zetner was now in the ascendancy. 100 Zetners were cautiously exercising a modicum of increased responsibility, waiting to see if the wind had really changed, or if it had just veered momentarily. The Zetners were coming into their own, and soon the cities of Asiatic Russia might reap a new harvest of administrators. Bardief found nothing dismaying in the prospect. He had survived too much to become alarmed over power struggles in high places, or even to worry very much about his own survival. He would fight for it, but he refused to worry about it. This sort of thing had happened 12 times in the past, and now, like then, the last word had not been spoken. If a first round had gone to Zetner and those he represented, there were still other rounds to fight, and somewhere in the unreadable future, a victory to be gained. Therefore, sustained by a stoical philosophy, steadfast against hope or despair, Bardief continued to work with Zetner,
single-mindedly and to the best of his ability toward the goal of contacting the spy and the ancillary goal of eliminating Dane and the woman Susan Bellows. But he couldn't repress a sigh of regret at the thought of not writing the fitness report on Zettner. At present, there was no one he could send it to. Stephen Dane was in a comparable, though less delicate, situation. He had been given $5,000 from special projects with which to buy back the stolen papers, but the thief had not turned up again. There weren't even any promising leads, and this led to divided opinions in the Paris branch of Central Intelligence. These opinions were reflected upon in Washington. After considering all sides of the problem, the relevant authority in Washington sent out a directive stating that something had to be done immediately. Something was done. Early one morning, Dane's presence was requested at Army Intelligence in Paris. Two armed guards examined his credentials and took him to a receptionist, who examined his credentials again. Then the guards escorted him to the office of Colonel Nestor. Nestor was a bulky man, short and red-faced, almost neckless, with close-cropped gray bristles and small, deep, very blue eyes. It was well known that Nestor didn't hold with bureaucratic fumbling. He was a military man, 28 years in the service, and he didn't approve of civilians. This was not to say he didn't like them. Some of his best friends were civilians. He simply didn't approve of their torturous way of doing the simplest and most obvious things, their insistence on finding shades of gray in the most clear-cut black-and-white issues, their general muddle-headedness. Civilians seemed incapable of going directly to the heart of a matter. Even congressmen, usually a soldier's best friend in the outside world, couldn't understand the real simplicity of most things. Although naturally sympathetic to military needs, congressmen sometimes felt impelled to talk about such vague generalities as public opinion, the easily bruised feelings of allies, the state of the budget, and other inapropos subjects. Colonel Nestor couldn't understand that kind of thinking. If a thing had to be done, what was the sense of worrying about the social consequences, especially since everything the military did was for society? Nestor had frequently talked these matters over with his colleagues, who, varying with their temperaments, found civilian obstructionism amusing, pathetic, inevitable, or irritating. Nestor fell into this last class. He occasionally expressed his opinions very frankly, a fact which had much to do with his remaining a colonel for 7 years, and he insisted upon an immediate, precise, no-nonsense solution to any problem. It was this last quality which had brought Nestor to his present position as operational head of Army Intelligence for Europe. It was well known that Nestor could and would be as tough as any Red. Nestor could never be accused of the vague good-heartedness, the amiable naivete which stigmatized so many Americans. Nestor could play the commies game and play it better than the commies. And after too many setbacks in too many places, this gave Nestor's superiors a sensation of confidence. Nestor's sector of the Cold War, at least, would not be lost through lack of effort or a misplaced nicety in the exercise of means.
"Dane," Colonel Nestor said immediately, "we aren't getting results."
Dane began to outline the situation, but Nestor interrupted him.
"I've read the reports. I know what has been done and what is being done. It isn't enough. We aren't getting results."
"At the moment," Dane said, "there isn't anything to do. We have to wait." This was precisely the sort of thing that was guaranteed to make Nestor angry, this passive civilian insistence on waiting for somebody else to do something.
"You think we should just sit around, is that it?"
"There's nothing else to do at the moment."
"Isn't there?"
Nestor said scathingly.
"Perhaps you don't appreciate the importance of those stolen papers."
"I think I do."
"It doesn't sound that way to me. Dane, we want those papers back. Not, it would be nice to have them back, or we'll take them back if something nice happens. No, we want them back, and we're damned well going to get them back."
"How?" Dane asked. Colonel Nestor nodded approvingly.
"That's a little more like it. How? That's our problem. Not when or if something nice happens, but how."
"Yes, Colonel."
"Let me sum up the facts. We know that a man of probable Spanish or Latin American nationality had possession of those papers. This man is probably a sailor. We surmise that he is a freelance spy, unaffiliated with any activist political organization. We know that he has made two attempts to sell the papers, once to the Russians and once to us. He has been frustrated at both attempts. Do you agree with that?"
Since it was excerpted largely from his own reports, Dane nodded in agreement.
"Next,"
Nestor said,
We must predicate, to the best of our ability, the man's next move. I've had a talk about that with the planning board. It's a simple matter, really. A question of putting yourself in the other fellow's shoes and deciding what would be your best plan. Well, his best plan would be the following. To learn the names, either from newspapers or friends, of communist agents, diplomats, or sympathizers here in Paris, and to contact them through an intermediary. Do you agree?
Abstractly, that might be his best plan, Dane said. But I think we must allow for other possibilities. The thief hasn't got a planning board. He might do something quite different.
Yes, he might do something different, the colonel said. But this would be his best plan. We can't concentrate ourselves with 1,000 possibilities. The man might drop dead of a heart attack. That's possible, too. No, we must deal with the most probable plan, and deal with it to the absolute limit of our ability.
I think we're doing that.
I do not. Do we have a cover on every known communist in Paris? On party members? Important sympathizers?
Well, that's physically impossible.
It is not, Nestor said. I've called in intelligence men from all over Europe. We'll cover Paris like a blanket.
What if the thief goes to a different city?
That's not our concern at the moment. We must take the most probable line of action and follow it to the limit of our capabilities.
Even if it means leaving ourselves dangerously undermanned elsewhere?
It will be dangerous, Nestor stated. Only in the event of strong enemy activity in another sector. When that happens, we will deal with it. If it happens. But we will not attempt to deal with it while it remains only one of 1,000 possibilities.
We need Secret Service coverage over the rest of Europe, Dane said.
I'll have to correct you on that. We need Secret Service coverage at specific times. When those times come, we will provide for them, instantly. It's an old infantry tactic, Mr. Dane, to concentrate your forces if you aim for a breakthrough, instead of dispersing them over 100 points.
Infantry tactics are not the same as intelligence tactics, Dane said.
They're close enough. The rule is surely capable of many applications.
Also, Dane said, many of the men you're recalling are on specific and very important assignments. To interrupt them now, Nestor waved his hand impatiently. He hated this sort of petty detail. It only obscured the main issue.
That's my decision and my responsibility, he told Dane. I have already issued the necessary orders.
The colonel hesitated over a bit of trick phraseology.
I trust that you will accommodate yourself to this scheme. We need every trained man we can get in Paris. I have drawn up a master plan.
I'm sorry, Dane said.
I beg your pardon.
I'm not under your command.
Your orders are to cooperate to the fullest with Army Intelligence.
It's a reciprocal order. Army Intelligence is also requested to cooperate with me.
Dane, you're being obstructive. What do you propose to do?
Dane smiled and shrugged his shoulders.
I must know, Colonel Nestor said with unusual patience. It has to be coordinated with the plan.
I don't know myself, Dane said. When there's an opportunity to do something, I'll do it. In the meantime, I'll wait.
That's a sloppy way of working.
Your predecessor didn't think so? That was a sore point. Nestor's predecessor, now a lieutenant general, had gone on to greater things. No such promotion was in sight for Nestor. The colonel rose to his feet.
I ought to take this up with Washington.
I wish you would, Dane said. Is there anything else, Colonel? Fine, I'll contact you if anything happens. Dane left the office. The colonel sat down again, brooding on the blatant way in which civilians were losing the Cold War after the military had saved their skins in the Hot War. End of chapter 14. Chapter 15 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 15. They sat together on a park bench in Vienna, their limbs stiff from the long coach ride across Europe. Overhead, pigeons wheeled against a desolate slate sky, and Vienna's soiled yellow and gray buildings stood like aged and indifferent sightseers behind the wide boulevards.
No, Anna said. I don't think you should do it.
Carlos didn't answer. He looked at the blonde woman with something not far from hatred. What did she want, this foreign woman who had attached herself to him with the remorseless ease of a burr sticking to clothing? She had helped him buy a second-class ticket in Amsterdam, and she had talked to him about unimportant matters on the train to Paris. There she had gone with him, Docile as a dog, undemanding and unsurprised, to live in a tiny room and wait while he plotted his scheme for riches. He hadn't minded, he was used to having a woman somewhere around. They were usually foreign, and therefore mute and without influence over him. Their voices were like the singing of birds, enjoyable and never to be taken seriously. Women were a part of life, indispensable but not to be valued for their individuality. All except this woman, Anna, who had somehow crept deeper into the recesses of his life than any woman he had ever known except his mother. He had let her live with him without question. Why question a thing so natural? He had let her share that small vital portion of his life that centered on food and bed. And one night in Paris, suicidally depressed over his failure with the American diplomat, he had told her the whole story of the top secret. She had listened without comment, seemingly without comprehension, her pale hair drawn back, hands folded placidly in her lap. But she understood. Anna understood everything he had said in his strange English, translating his tone and the expression of his hands even faster than the words themselves. Like him, she was a foreigner, forced to listen to other people's languages. She had understood far more than his words, for the strain showed clearly on him. The strain of trying to seize a fortune from violent, quick-tempered men who killed each other for the sake of words on paper. Carlos knew that a fugitive was like a diseased man. Others heard the leper's bell and ran. But Anna had stayed with him, accepting his forced marches toward disaster, watching the unskilled Novoyero, possessing nothing but his cape and his courage, trying to find wealth and happiness between the curving horns of the bull. She had shared her money with him, and Carlos had taken it, for that was the sort of thing which women did. Proximity gave her courage. She had asked finally why he had to sell the plans.
"I want money."
"What for?"
"To buy a farm somewhere in Australia."
She had looked surprised. She had been born on a farm, she told him. Farms were filthy affairs. Farms meant the guts of chickens and the entrails of cows. Why would anyone want a farm?
"Listen to me," Carlos said. "I know what a farm is. I know a farm is stupid. Do you think I love cows and chickens? Am I such a fool as to enjoy corn or wheat? I know what a farm is."
"Then why did he want one?" Carlos struggled to tell her. With a sensation of the terrible inadequacy of his words, he spoke to her about the cities and the ports of the world, the break-back labor, the starving man's wage, the lifetime of filth in the bowels of a machine.
"Listen to me. Do you know those buildings, those great white buildings that stand near the docks in Veracruz, London, New York, anywhere in the world? Those have been built because of the ships, and those buildings are kept white on my wages. In order for there to be buildings and ships, we live like the filthiest Indian. We live worse. Some of us are sailors, and others push big carts of dresses in New York, or dig in the mud of Tampico, or wash dishes in Galveston. It is all the same. We live. It is bearable. We hope. But then we die, and the hope is also dead. Can you understand what I am talking about?"
In the dim light, he thought she nodded, so he went on.
"All of them hope. The sailors, and the men who farm on shares, and dishwashers, and the cart pushers. I tell you, I've talked to them. They have hope. They never realize they'll die. And that's just what happens. There's never enough time to do anything about their hope, and they die."
Carlos stared down at his feet. His face might have been carved from obsidian, his hands twisted together with growing tension.
"Sometimes I've sat with them. I've watched them die. And then they understand they've been cheated. Man has cheated them, and they know in their hearts that God will cheat them too. Then those dying ones wish they could rise from the bed and smash the white buildings. They wish they could take something from life. But then it's too late. They were spoken to like children all their lives, and the soldiers of the police walked around with guns, so they thought they had too much to lose. They kept on washing dishes, and only when they were dying they realized that there was nothing to lose. Nothing at all."
Carlos paused for breath. Anna sat silently, waiting.
"Do you know what men like that believe?"
Carlos said.
"They believe that everyone lies. The man who owns the ship, the man who owns the store, and the priest who owns the church, they lie. All of them lie. The priest talks about heaven. But do you know what these men believe? They believe there will be dirty dishes and pushcarts even in heaven. That's what God had in mind. That's why he made them practice their trade on earth."
"You shouldn't blaspheme, Anna said. Priests can lie, but God never lies.
Carlos shrugged his shoulders. Women were filled with strange little beliefs. They accepted what men told them, even priests, and they continued to believe even when they were dying. His mother had been a believer. She had never wavered. The priest had prayed over her, and perhaps the black flies that hovered over her face had prayed too.
It doesn't matter what's in heaven, Carlos said. I'm telling you what's on earth. I've seen the world, and it's filled with filth, and there's nothing to hope for. That's why I must become rich, so I can buy a farm.
And then you will employ others to work on your farm?
Carlos shook his head vehemently.
No others, only me. A farm and a rifle. That's what I want. I'll do the work of three men, but it must be entirely my own.
You'll die like all the others, Anna said.
That's all right, as long as I die on my own land, in my own filth.
Perhaps she agreed with him. In any event, she didn't try to argue. He wanted a farm like children want the moon, and she wanted him, stayed with him, would go to a farm or to death itself with him. Not out of love, that was too luxurious a feeling for her and too expensive for him. She stayed with him because she had met him and liked him, grown quickly used to him, because he was short and muscular and brown, feverishly alive, because he could still grin as he ran across Europe with death wadded into his jacket pocket, because he possessed, in spite of himself, that strange masculine ability to hope when there was absolutely nothing to hope for. Even if his dream was absurd and suicidal, the man himself was not. He had become hers, so she stayed with him. Carlos would have scorned a marriage in a church, but Anna knew when she had become his wife, and then she gave him advice.
We must leave Paris now.
Anna, are you crazy? Leave this place before we sell the secrets.
Too many people are looking for you here. I read it in the papers.
Carlos had to bow before the superior wisdom of a newspaper reader. With the last of their money, they had gone to Vienna, far from Paris, far from the ocean. Anna had explained her choice.
It is a big city, like Paris, easy to hide in, and I can understand the language. It is near the countries which the Russians rule. The newspapers say there are always plenty of Russians in Vienna. It will be easier to sell the plans there.
Carlos had accepted her greater knowledge of the political world, but not happily. Women could talk very logically, but they always left something out. So here they were in Vienna, a cold, ruined city. They were without money, without a room, without food, and still no closer to selling the damned secrets. As if that weren't enough, Anna was now opposing the only good idea Carlos had thought of.
"Listen to me," Carlos said. "We are sitting on a bench, without food, without money. I can't just walk up to some Russian and sell the secrets. You said so yourself. It will take a few days at least. And what will we eat in that time? Where will we sleep?"
"I don't want you to steal," Anna said, as though she hadn't heard him.
"You don't want me to steal? How do you think I got the secrets?"
"That was for something else. That was for something important. Something for the farm."
"And how will I live to see this farm if I don't eat?"
"If you steal, they will catch you."
"Never."
"It will bring bad luck."
"The only luck I ever had has been bad. What do I care about luck?"
"Still, to risk the farm."
"I thought you didn't like farms."
"I don't, but it is as you say. It's better than anything else I can think of. Will we both go to this farm in Australia?"
"Of course, why not?"
"What will you do if you can't get money for the farm?"
"I will kill myself."
"Promise me that you won't."
"Of course I won't. Now let's stop this stupid talk. Sit here. I'll be back in an hour."
Carlos was gone much longer than an hour. Anna sat on the bench in watery sunlight, among wheeling gray pigeons, watching the crowds. Policemen went by. They gave her a quick, professional look as they passed. They could sense something wrong in a woman who sat alone on a bench while others went about their jobs. One policeman stopped and asked her with ominous politeness whether he could be of service.
"I am waiting for my husband."
Of course she was waiting for her husband, but she had been sitting on the bench for a long time. Was this husband lost, perhaps?
"He has gone to look for a hotel room. I was tired. I said I would wait for him here."
Her clothes were still good enough. She hadn't spoken to any of the passing men and had turned away from the few who had spoken to her. Her calmness was fatalistic, but the policeman took it for innocence.
"I hope he comes soon, madam, if I can help in any way."
"Thank you very much.
She was an inconspicuous woman except in the eyes of Carlos and the police. Carlos returned shortly after sunset, his eyes glittering, his shirt torn and stuffed loosely into his pants. He was nervous and happy. He had gone hunting in the market and had caught a fat purse.
What happened then?
They tried to chase me.
Your shirt?
An accident. I caught it on the railing.
The purse?
I dropped it in a trash can.
He showed her a respectable wad of shillings. He was a careful thief, cunning and patient, and he had waited for the right prey and the best opportunity. He detested stealing because it hurt his pride, but he was willing to make even that sacrifice for his dream.
All right, Anna said. We must find a hotel now, and eat a meal, and then I shall do something about your ridiculous secrets.
You?
Of course, me. They know what you look like. It's better if I do it, or if I hire someone, the friend of a thief.
I can do that myself, Carlos said.
And get killed.
Don't be stupid.
But she convinced him of the necessity, and Carlos, with ill grace, agreed. As they left the bench, Anna asked,
Did anyone see you when you stole the purse?
I suppose so. I was forced to knock down a policeman.
End of chapter 15.
Rivalry that shaped football. The players who defined an era. For the first time ever in LA, the icons of FC Barcelona and Real Madrid take the pitch at BMO Stadium. Watch the Legend Series, FC Barcelona Legends versus Real Madrid Leyendas, live in LA on February 22nd at BMO Stadium. For tickets and exclusives, go to wearehouseofheroes.com.